Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Dana Dennis, and I'm one of the hosts of the Anthropology Channel. Today, we're going to be talking with author Mark Leakdy about his book, Far Out, Countercultural Seekers and the Tourist Encounter in Nepal. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Dana Dennis, and I'm one of the hosts of the Anthropology Channel. Today, we're going to be talking with author Mark Leakdy about his book, Far Out, Countercultural Seekers and the Tourist Encounter in Nepal. I'm really excited about this conversation with Mark. And before we get started, just as a teaser, I wanted to read you a few sentences from the introduction of the book. So he says, Far Out tells the story of how generations of counterculturally inclined Westerners have imagined Nepal as a land untainted by modernity and its capital, Kathmandu, as a veritable synonym of Oriental mystique. What are the forms and consequences of these shifting countercultural projections since Nepal, and Kathmandu in particular, has become a tourist destination? Over the generations, how has Nepal figured into the Western imagination? How have these imagined Nepals changed through time? And how have each touristic generation's dreams shaped the kinds of tourism that emerged? Conversely, how did Nepalis respond to their, quote, discovery by throngs of foreigners? And how did foreigners and Nepalis alike make sense of some of the most bizarre characters and countercultural trends that the 20th century had produced? So that is all of that and more what we're going to be talking about today with author Mark Leakdy. Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Dana Dennis, one of the hosts of the Anthropology Channel, and I'm here with Mark Leakdy, a professor in anthropology and history at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Mark is the co-editor of the journal Studies in Nepali History and Society, and much of his published work to date explores the emergence of middle-class consumer culture in Nepal. We're here to talk about his new book, Far Out, Countercultural Seekers and the Tourist Encounter in Nepal, which came out last year, 2017, from the University of Chicago Press. It's a really delightful book, and it received the 2017 Keiku Nairoji Book Award for Himalayan Literature. So Mark, welcome to the show. We're really excited to talk to you today. Can you tell us a little bit first about how you came to write this book?
Yeah, this is a project that I've been interested in for many years. In fact, I've been collecting material on for probably close to 30 years. But that information generally went into a folder somewhere and was put on hold until I reached a point in my career where I felt that I could go back and work on a project that wasn't quite down the straight and narrow path of academic anthropology. And so looking into the history of tourism is a topic, especially in Nepal, I think is a fascinating topic for lots of people. But for me, it's a topic that had special interest, at least in part because of my own personal background. For a variety of reasons, I had been able to, I had spent time in South Asia, on and off since childhood. And in fact, my first visit to Nepal was in 1969, when I was just a nine-year-old boy, when my parents and family were living on the subcontinent, and we visited the city at what I now realize was sort of the peak moment of the hippie phenomenon in Nepal. And it's something that as a nine-year-old, I was kind of vaguely aware of. But in fact, as the years have gone by, it's something that I wanted. I became more and more interested in the phenomenon that drove these strange people to this out-of-the-way place back in the 60s and 70s, and wanted to learn more about it. And for years, I've been looking for some kind of book that would tell me, what would answer those questions. You know, what is it that created Nepal as this particular kind of tourist destination, and in particular for a certain kind of countercultural Western figure? Why this fascination with this place? And as I looked for that book to read to explain those questions to me, I realized that, number one, that book didn't exist. And number two, if I wanted to read that book, I was probably going to have to write it myself. And so that's what I eventually did. And it took quite a while to do so, but that's the sort of where this book comes from, to answer my own questions. And, you know, one of the main questions that I had with regard to this whole tourist phenomenon is, where did people get their ideas about Nepal? And in particular, how does Nepal emerge as this exotic, often spiritually, fascinating place for generations of Westerners? Why, and not just Nepal, but the Himalayas in general, how do the Himalayas become this place of desire where the West can imagine a different kind of world from their own? And as I dug into that question, you know, what I realized, or what I discovered, was that the kinds of images that Westerners have had of Nepal and the Himalayas broadly are not just things that characterized the moment of the 60s and 70s and the hippie generation, but these fantasies and kind of imagined Himalayan places, these themes go way back in European and American history. And so as I dug further into this, I realized that in effect, the hippie phenomenon and the kinds of images that drove people to Nepal at that time were only the latest kind of reincarnation of a general theme of longing that gets projected onto Nepal by literally generations, even centuries of countercultural people.
Thanks so much. Yeah, that is a really fascinating part of the book, thinking about where did these ideas come from, these ideas about Nepal as a kind of Shangri-La, as a mystical place that fulfills some kind of longing or imagination that Westerners have created kind of almost in complete isolation from what actually is happening in Nepal, because Nepal is pretty much closed to Westerners until the early 1950s. So could you tell us a little bit more about what some of those ideas were and how they developed and how they maybe how they were challenged a little bit when people started to go to Nepal and actually experience Nepal as tourists in the 1950s?
Yeah, let me try to do that. It's obviously a complicated story, but I mean, I think there would be various places where you could begin this narrative, going back, you know, probably at least into the 18th century. But I think I decided to try to begin the story kind of in the mid to late 19th century, because this is a moment when the West is going through the Industrial Revolution, and they're, in addition to its fixation on modernization and development, the West is this moment has also created a kind of powerful backlash of reaction against the kind of rapid modernizations that are happening at the time. And this backlash gets represented in all kinds of forms, from the whole movement of Romanticism in literature to the emergence of a Marxist critique of capitalism at that time. But you also, one of the kind of flavors of discontent and anti-modern sentiment is one that is associated with this movement that we know today as Theosophy. And so I begin the story of the sort of European fixation on the Himalayas with Madame Blavatsky and Theosophy. And, one could go into more or less detail, but I think, among other things, it's Blavatsky who, for a whole variety of reasons, begins to focus her own anti-Western critique on a kind of imagined non-West and an other place where the contaminations and discontents of Western modernity do not apply. And what's more, for her, the Himalayas become this place where a kind of ancient wisdom persists that will, in effect, liberate or enlighten the West and bring it out of its current alienated condition. And so she turns to the Himalayas as this resource, of course, an imagined resource for a kind of countercultural critique of Western modernity at the time. And so it's Madame Blavatsky who claims to be in mystical psychic communication with what she calls the Himalayan Brotherhood, or the Great White Brotherhood of the Himalayas. These are astral spirits that she says reside in the hidden fastness of the high Himalayas, and she is able to communicate with these people psychically. In fact, she has a cupboard in her house where daily she opens a small drawer, and there are written communications to her, written on rice paper, from these Himalayan masters. And so this is how she communicates with this esoteric, hidden fount of or repository of wisdom that lies buried or hidden mystically in the Himalayas. And so the Himalayas emerge, like I said, as this bastion of wisdom that preserves an ancient esoteric knowledge that is not only valuable in itself, but will in effect redeem the West. And so Theosophy offers this this promise of redemption for the ills of modernity, and that message was very appealing. We forget, or I had no idea. I had long heard of Theosophy, but I had no idea that, around a century ago, Theosophy was it was a bit out there, but it numbered among its adherents many, many people that we today regard very highly, everyone from Einstein and Edison to Mahatma Gandhi and William James, and all kinds of people were theosophists. That doesn't necessarily mean that they embraced all of the kind of strange stuff that we associate with Theosophy today. But nevertheless, this was a powerful movement. And Madame Blavatsky has been called probably the most influential woman of the late 19th and early 20th century. And so it's Blavatsky, among others, who helped create the Himalayas as this imagined countercultural zone, but also in a way feed off of an image that had already existed before Blavatsky's time. But it's certainly at this point in the late 19th, early 20th century, with the effect of theosophy, that the Himalayas emerge as this screen on which the West can project its longings, its desires, and try to find redemption from its own alienation.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great answer. I found Madame Blavatsky to be such a fascinating character, someone I certainly didn't know very much about before reading the book. And I think one thing that's really remarkable to me is just how durable some of her ideas about Nepal and the Himalayas still are. For instance, as I was rereading that part of the book in preparation for this interview, I was thinking about the Marvel movie, Doctor Strange, that came out in 2016. And actually, part of the movie was filmed in Kathmandu when I was there in 2015 doing my fieldwork. And everyone was very excited. You know, Benedict Cumberbatch was in town. It was a big deal. But very much still participating in these ideas of the Tibetan Brotherhood and the source of some ancient mystical wisdom that can purify or save the West from its own failings or something like that. So, yeah, Madame Blavatsky, I think, is still with us in some ways in terms of how people think about Nepal.
I fully agree. And that whole Doctor Strange movie is just this kind of orgy of exoticism and frankly silliness. And one thing that I was kind of surprised at is apparently in the original Doctor Strange comic book, Nepal doesn't even figure into the story. This was somehow built into the modern day script and screenplay. But yes, in this current film, Kathmandu sort of stands as the, its location is sort of like the navel of the universe. All the rest of the film is shot in Hong Kong and New York and London. And then there's Kathmandu. But Kathmandu is, of course, where the hero goes in order to be enlightened and enlightened. Right, exactly, and acquires the mystical powers that make him the superhero, and of course he acquires these powers from a quasi-Buddhist Western nun figure who is played by Tilda Swinton. But I don't know if this is the place to bring this in, but in a lot of ways, Tilda Swinton character. Is an echo of one of the main characters in James Hilton's 1930s bestseller Lost Horizon, and Lost Horizon on the one hand is premised on all kinds of theosophical ideas, but like you suggest, it also these tropes live on today, because in Lost Horizon, you have the monastery of the Blue Moon, located in a valley called Shangri-La, in hidden in the Himalayas, but the people who live in Shangri-La, or at least in the monastery. We discover in reading the novel are not Himalayans. They're not Tibetans. They're not some form of local people. They are instead mainly Westerners, and especially the leadership of the lamasery in Shangri-La is the high lama turns out to be in the book a Catholic priest from Luxembourg. So you have this bizarre combination in that novel of this quasi-Buddhist figure who is actually Western, And that then reappears in this this last year's whatever it was film Doctor Strange, where you have the leader of the monastery is this weird mix up of Western and Asian, but in both cases it's that place in the Himalayas where one goes in order to be transformed and empowered. So I agree completely that these tropes of the exoticized and empowering and mystical Himalayas have been around for centuries, and they seem to just be undeterred even today. I could show you interviews that Cumberbatch and others, the directors of the film gave, in which they repeat these sort of Himalayan exotic platitudes almost verbatim to things I could, lift out of 19th century accounts. It's just incredible. You have the director of the film saying how Kathmandu is the most spiritual place he's ever visited. He says it has the least Western influence of any city he's ever visited. It's quiet, peaceful, blah, blah, blah. I mean, anyone who's actually visited Kathmandu with a clear mind, I think, would have trouble recognizing the place that these people describe. But it's those fantasies that have not only driven this film, but also those are the fantasies that have driven centuries, or at least a century worth of seekers to the Himalayas.
Yeah, thank you. I led us on a little bit of a rabbit trail there, I should say, for our listeners. The stuff about Dr. Strange is not actually in the book, but I do think it's really important to talk about, because it shows, as we're saying, that these ideas about the mystical Himalaya as this place where Western seekers can go and become enlightened or discover their true selves or whatever it is that they want to do to sort of recover maybe from their own modernity or their own disillusionment or disenchantment, that Nepal or Tibet or the Himalaya represents a place where they can go and do that. And these tropes are really remarkably durable. So
all these things are alive and well.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm laughing, I was laughing as you were talking about what's been said about the movie, because it just reminded me of things that people often say to me when I tell them that I do field work in Nepal, and they think that I'm, just sort of like living in bliss in some quiet, peaceful village on a mountain or something. And I'm like, well, I live in Kathmandu, and there's a lot of air pollution. People are always like sort of aghast to hear that, because it just contrasts so drastically with what they've built up in their imaginations. But anyway, so speaking of the collision between imagination and reality, in the 1950s, Nepal, due to some internal political changes in its relationship with India and so forth, became open to Western visitors. And can you tell us a little bit more about those first people who actually came to Nepal as tourists, and maybe what kind of experiences they were looking for and what kind of things they found?
Yeah, this is interesting, because when Nepal is finally opened to potential Western tourism, this is at a moment when, on the one hand, you've had at least a century of kind of prefiguration, so that in 1950, Nepal has already been constructed in the Western imagination as this zone of desire. And simultaneously with Nepal's opening, as you said, in 1951, is the Chinese invasion of Tibet. So China effectively closes to Tibet to whatever little access Westerners had at almost exactly the moment that Nepal opens. And so this century worth of pent-up desire to visit the mystical Himalayas now finds finally an outlet in Nepal that is tentatively opening itself up to the world. And so you get a proto or initial wave of tourists in the 1950s. Now, bear in mind that in the 1950s, this is before the era of anything that we would now recognize as mass tourism. You know, the people, if you were a European or American, to get to Nepal was a very costly proposition, and it involved often travel literally by ocean liner. There was very little intercontinental air travel at the time. By the 50s, you had a situation where wealthy foreigners, mainly, you know, in the post-World War II context, that meant wealthy Americans and usually elderly wealthy Americans, would be going on round-the-world ocean tours. And they began to arrive in Nepal as parts of excursions or side trips from these around-the-world ocean tours. And so people would get off their boat in Bombay. They would fly across North India to Nepal, spend a couple days and nights in Kathmandu, fly back to Madras, where their ocean liner had arrived, and then continue on their world tour. So Nepal got sort of fit into the itineraries of a early wave of Western tourists in the post-war period. But part of my point is simply that the only people who could manage financially the very expensive and time-consuming trip to Nepal in the early decades were wealthy, usually elderly, usually Americans. And so Kathmandu becomes this, what today we would call a trophy destination for elites. Mm-hmm. And the kind of elites who go there, as I said, they're very different from the kinds that we associate with Nepal tourism in later decades. But let me also step back and say that the first hotels in Kathmandu first hotels of any kind of international standard were built precisely in order to accommodate these elderly, rich American tourists on their world tours. They were designed to accommodate the number of people that would fit on an airplane, which at the day in that day, you know, a DC-3 could take about 22 passengers. And so that was the standard load. And the standard, that's what hotels tried to accommodate. So you get this strange situation where you get very wealthy people showing up to tick off Kathmandu as a destination. But there are also lots of famous movie stars and politicians and wealthy business people who show up. And so the guest lists in the early hotels read like kind of a who's who of the mid 20th century, from, you know, royalty to movie stars.
Yeah, it's interesting. Kathmandu at that time seemed to have a certain glamour about it as a destination for those who could afford to get there. But then once they arrived, the accommodations were often not actually very glamorous, or had, you know, a certain kind of glamour mixed in with, you know, a lot of bed bugs or lack of hot water or those kinds of amenities or rats or all kinds of things, as the tourist infrastructure in Nepal was really just beginning to be built in the 1950s. And I really enjoyed the parts of the book that had to do with that. So, but then a change occurs, right? Because by the time you were in Nepal, for instance, as a child, it had become the sort of center of the hippie world, or a really important hippie destination. And you say in the book that, you know, the Overland Hippie Trail was called actually the Road to Kathmandu, as if it is not just a side trip anymore for wealthy people doing their around the world ocean liner tours, but for the hippies, Kathmandu is like a destination in and of itself. So can you tell us a little bit more about how that shift occurred?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. And I mean, in one way, it's a combination of demographics and technology, because as the post-war baby boom generation, this huge kind of swelling of the population that occurs after the war, as that generation comes of age, and as they come of age in the context of a booming Western economies, what you find is a growing population of middle-class young people with access to money, who enjoy the benefits of a very strong economy in a world that is still, the rest of the world is still, you know, in economic conditions that make travel, you know, if you can get out of the Western world, your money goes a very long distance. And so as the baby boom generation comes of age, as they have access to resources, and as the countercultural pendulum begins to swing back toward this sense of alienation and desire that came to characterize the 60s generation, as all those phenomena occur, again, Western countercultural eyes focus on Himalayas, and Kathmandu becomes the easiest access point to that exotic imagined world. So it begins slowly at first. I mean, even a decade before the word hippie had been coined, you have an earlier generation of kind of radicalized youth that we today associate with the Beat Generation. The Beat Generation is discovering South Asia. They are discovering so-called Eastern religion, and they're beginning to fixate on Asia in general, but on the Himalayas and Nepal in particular. And so by the mid-60s, you begin, when you look at tourist statistics that were kept by the Nepal government, you see an interesting phenomenon. The number of tourists is rising steadily, but the average age of tourist arrivals is also dropping fast. So within a decade, you see the average tourist in Nepal go from being elderly and rich to being young and middle class. And that represents this Western youth discovery of an Asian alternative place. And I mean, I think it's also worth pointing out that it's in this post-World War II baby boom generation that we really we find for the first time something that we would today call a youth culture. And part of that youth culture was wrapped up in the idea of rebellion against their parental generation. And part of the, you know, part of that rebellious impulse found expression in travel, and in so, you know, travel becomes a kind of metaphor for critique of the West. By leaving the West, one critiques it, and therefore, I think it strikes me that Kathmandu had a number of things going for it. But especially, let's say, if you were a North American, and if your goal was to get away from home and go away as far as possible, you literally could not go any farther away from home than Kathmandu. Kathmandu was on the other side of the world, and many people remarked that once they arrived in Nepal, any direction they went was back toward home. And so Nepal became this icon of distance and escape, and it became, you know, and therefore it became a very useful place to imagine the non-West, or a pre-modern West that was uncontaminated. It was as far away as you could get. That's the point. And distance then is thought, or is imagined to be somehow distance in not just in space, but in time, you know. Kathmandu is imagined as this pre-modern, non-modern place where one can still find a non-alienated existence. So so go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was just going to say, can you tell us a little bit more what that that non-alienated existence was like? Or just, you know, on a sort of day-to-day level, what did these folks do in Kathmandu? Were they just sort of sitting around imagining themselves, or, well, you know, what were they doing?
Yeah, well, certainly one, they were doing a lot of things, and not everyone was doing the same things. And
of course, yeah.
And, you know, there were a few people within this community of sort of resident foreign, whatever you want to call them, hippies or seekers. Some of them were deeply invested in Eastern religion. Some became serious practitioners of Hinduism, of Tibetan Buddhism. Some became, you know, very serious students of Asian history, for example. But those people were probably the minority among a larger population that was there more just for, I guess you could call it, escapist reasons. And on the one hand, they had good reason to escape. Many of these were anti-war activists who were looking to escape the draft. Others mm-hmm. were escaping what they felt was an oppressive Western culture that had, in some ways, declared war on Western youth culture. You know, many people experienced, for example, the Nixon era war on drugs as a war on youth and mm-hmm. war on youth expression. And so you see this explosion of youth arrivals in 1969. Right at the moment, following the election of Richard Nixon and that terrible tumultuous year of 1968, when youth countercultural hopes had risen very high, only to be just dashed in a terrible sequence of assassinations and riots and brutality. After that moment, many, many people fled the West and ended up in Kathmandu. And so these are people that were, you know, they do have a political orientation. But on the other hand, a lot of them saw Nepal and Kathmandu as, you know, like I said, as a place of escape, but also of, a place of pleasure. On the one hand, you know, well, they could hope to keep alive the kinds of Western youth cultural practices that they had tried to cultivate back home, which were increasingly unwelcome. That culture could be maintained in a place like Kathmandu. And, you know, one has to raise the topic of drugs, so-called drugs, because to the extent that mind-altering substances had been important to the countercultural generation of the 60s back in the West, those continue to be important in Nepal. And frankly, one of Nepal's attractions was its cheap and high-quality cannabis products. You know, so Nepali hashish became world famous. And in fact, many people told me that the first time they ever heard of Nepal was by reading the labels of hashish packets that they bought on the streets of New York or Toronto. So Nepal gets associated with cannabis and drugs broadly, and that whole psychedelic culture then is kept alive in Nepal at a time when it was increasingly under pressure and, in fact, criminalized back at home, because in Nepal laws, there were no laws against the commerce and consumption of cannabis products. So to answer your question, I mean, for better or worse, for quite a number of people, one of the attractions of Nepal was its access to mind-altering substances. And by all accounts, many, many people spent much of their time in Nepal stoned, which you can, however you want to deal with that.
Sure. If they weren't able to do it in Richard Nixon's America, they could always go to Kathmandu, at least for a while there while it was legal. So one of the things that I really love about the book, and I think is really important about the book, is that it's not just about sort of recounting the experiences and the perspectives of these Westerners coming to Nepal, but you have a lot of really rich material about Nepali people's perspectives on the development of tourism and the hippie era. Can you tell us a little bit more about the many ways that Nepali people encountered these strange foreigners and what they were able to learn and to gain through these intercultural encounters?
Yeah, I can try.
This is a big part of the book, so I'm asking you to sum it up.
You're absolutely right that I really, really wanted to make this book not just about the foreign experience of Nepal, but the Nepali experience of foreigners. And yet, this is ethnographically and historically, this is a challenge, because as a foreigner myself, asking questions of Nepalis about the past is a little bit fraught, in that there's a discourse about tourism that Nepalis have among themselves that they don't often share with foreigners. And so I want to premise my remarks here by saying that I'm very grateful to a number of Nepali co-workers who I worked with, who were able to do a series of interviews with all kinds of people that brought in information and perspectives that I personally never could have gotten. Even if I was asking the same questions to the same people, I likely would not have gotten the same answers. And so I'm grateful to Nepali co-workers for opening up some really important perspectives. But that said, I mean, what we learned was that it was very difficult for Nepalis to figure out who these people were. On the one hand, you know, in the earlier decades of the tourism phenomenon, the elderly foreigners that came fit the Nepali idea of what foreigners were, basically clean cut.
They were rich.
Rich, clean cut, kind of respectable people, mm-hmm. that fit the bill of a kind of colonial imagination, what, for example, the British had hoped to project as a Western identity of elite power. The early generation of tourists fit that definition. However, when these young people began to show up, and show up barefoot and bedraggled and in some extreme cases, poor and literally begging on the streets, Nepalis had to figure out what was going on. And at first, it was very confusing. But among other things, I mean, some people that we talked to, some people understood these new ragged foreigners who were often interested in religion Nepalese interpreted them as some version of a religious ascetic, someone like a sadhu or a fakir or one of these South Asian religious renunciants. And so that was an existing category that some people could use to try to fit these foreigners into it. And in some ways, it wasn't a bad fit because these people often were interested in religion. They were often very, anti-establishment, countercultural types, which is exactly how you would describe, for example, some of these radical Hindu sadhus who go around smeared with ash and, upturning all social conventions. So, yeah, for some people, these foreigners were kind of weird religious ascetics. For other people, they look to these, people of another generation look to these young foreigners as bearers of modern consumer goods, for example. So Nepali youth by this time are well informed about what's going on in global youth culture, youth fashions. Nepali young people are interested in jeans and Levi's and that kind of thing, and so you get a commerce between these foreigners, these foreign hippies, and local Nepali young people in goods like clothing, records, electronics, and what have you. And still other Nepalese, maybe a smaller minority, saw these foreigners as seekers. And so a certain number of Nepalese, especially more intellectually inclined, these were people that were also on their own kind of spiritual quests, or at least intellectual quests, that often had to do with questioning the nature and value of modernity and its promises. And so you find a number of very interesting cases of intersection between Nepali intellectuals and the more intellectually inclined among this generation of hippie arrivals. And so there you find a very different kind of relationship. And so I guess all I'm saying is that there's a whole spectrum of different responses and understandings that Nepalis brought to their encounter with these foreigners.
Yeah, definitely. And it's a really a fascinating thing to read about this broad spectrum of interactions and to think about my own interactions in Nepal with folks, starting from 2011 in my first visit there. And I guess in a way I'm sort of thinking about the genealogy of those kinds of interactions. I don't remember if I ever told you this story, but, when I'm in Nepal doing field work, I try to dress in what I consider to be a sort of respectable way. I don't really want to look like a hippie or a Dharma bum. That doesn't accord with my self-perception, I guess, as an anthropologist. But my host family that I lived with for several years, one day presented me with a pair of these like drop crotch pants that a lot of tourists wear. Mm-hmm. And they said to me, they're like, "We noticed that all the other white people have some of these and you don't. So we thought you might like to have them." And I was a little mortified, but also I was like, I see where they got this idea. And I never wore the pants outside of the house, but they make great pajamas. So
yeah, you should dress like your own species.
Right? Yeah, exactly. They were like, "You don't seem like you know how to be a white person very well. We're going to help you out." Mm-hmm. It was a very kind impulse on their part.
Yeah.
So then the last part of the book, focuses on kind of the closing of what we might consider like the golden age of the hippies in Nepal due to, for instance, changes in Nepal's laws regarding marijuana and other drugs, and a sort of rebranding that takes place in the tourist industry in Nepal where adventure tourism kind of becomes the focus. And that's both adventure in terms of sort of physical adventures like going trekking, going rafting, but what you also call like spiritual adventure or adventures of self-discovery, which kind of follows on some of the stuff that we've been talking about. So can you explain a little bit how that transition came about and why you see those kind of two forms of adventure tourism as parallel with each other in some ways?
Well, to begin with, I mean, one of the things I try to stress is that around the mid-1970s, Nepal, for the first time, really embraces tourism as an industry. Up until this time, tourism had been a relatively marginal part of the economy. But at a certain point, Nepalis discover that there is serious money to be made. And it's at that point that a combination of state and business leaders grab the Nepal tourism product. And for the first time, they begin to think of Nepal as a product. And that product is something that can then be sold and marketed and, as you say, branded. Now, the problem was for these people that the kinds of tourists that were dominating the market in the early 1970s were these hippies that, the goal of this kind of radical youth generation was often to spend as much time in Nepal as possible and spend as little money as possible, which makes them not ideal tourists from the viewpoint of business. And so this new branding process of Nepal, where Nepal begins to manage itself, is one of the first things that they do is to try to get rid of the hippies and to try to transform Nepal's brand image away from that hippie phenomenon. That involves, finally, the delegalization of cannabis, which in some ways was more of a symbolic act than something that had much of an impact. But they also begin to promote Nepal as a tourist destination, as an adventure destination. So this is the time at which the state begins to heavily promote trekking. Trekking is a phenomenon that had been around for a while, but the state uses trekking from the mid-70s onward as the kind of linchpin to its promotion, because trekking is something that can bring in more money and attract a different kind of person that's not going to just sit around and smoke pot. That's the logic. So trekking becomes...
Get them out there in the mountains.
And the other fact of the matter is that by the mid-1970s, the whole countercultural pendulum had again begun to swing back toward more conservative forms of expression. And so with the economic downturn of the 70s, you don't have the same kind of economies that made hippie tourism possible. And in that context, people still wanted to come to Nepal, but they didn't. Those who came tended more to be young professional types who had access to money, but not much time. So they were kind of the inverse of the hippies who had lots of time and no money. These people, the new tourists, had money, but not much time. And so trekking became a product that could be fit into an adventure holiday, an adventure vacation. So, and in fact, this became very successful. Nepal is among the first and to this day primary, world destinations for trekking, not surprisingly, because of the mountains that it has to offer that are without parallel in the world. So this is one kind of adventure then, and we see the emergence of a huge trekking economy that is still vital to Nepal's tourism industry now. But also, I argue that in a way, we also see the reemergence of a kind of spiritual tourism that had been around for a long time. The whole idea of the Dharma bum goes back to a Kerouac book from the 50s, but it's really in the 80s and 90s that Nepal emerges for a new generation of religious seekers as a primary destination, at least, well, primarily, I would say, because of the world's growing fascination with Tibetan Buddhism. And again, with Tibet itself shut, Nepal becomes a kind of quasi-Tibet for these people. And notably, both Tibetans and Nepalis take advantage of this fact and begin to actively court Western Tibetan Buddhist seekers. And so part of what I try to describe in the last chapter is really the birth of Tibetan Buddhism's outreach to the world, partly as a strategy of self-survival. But you see this emerging first in the first Western-oriented monasteries in Nepal or in the world for Tibetan Buddhism. And as Tibetan Buddhism spreads in popularity around the world, more and more people turn to Nepal as a place of spiritual destination, a place to engage in meditation retreats and what have you. And so I see, and all of these product, these religious oriented products are in effect just that. They are bought and sold. And so I consider them to be a form of adventure and adventure tourism in itself. So that's one of the topics that I try to explore in the last chapter, which is also to suggest that many of the same exoticizing, spiritualizing trends that have characterized Western perceptions of Nepal from, for centuries, again, are very much alive and well and manifest in this phenomenon of Dharma tourism.
It's not often, I will say, as a reader, it's not often that I get to the end of a book that's almost 400 pages long. And I think, no, more of the story. What comes next? Because the book does end roughly around the early 1980s. But I was, eager to keep reading because, I see so many of these things sort of carrying over and continuing to evolve in the present day.
You can write that
book. No, I was about to say, are you going to write that book? Because I would happily read a sequel to this one. For our listeners, I want you all to know that this is a really rich book. We've barely scratched the surface, but I've kept Mark on the line now for almost an hour. So, Mark, I wanted to ask you, are there any things about the book that we haven't gotten to talk about yet that you would like to highlight?
Well, I think this is a work that is not overtly theoretical in any shape or form, and partly because I wanted this book to be accessible and fun for a reader. But I will say that I do have some sort of covert quasi-theoretical agendas in the book, and foremost among them is simply to argue that that tourism is a phenomenon that does not just happen to Nepal or Nepalis, but that is actively managed by Nepal and Nepalis. And from the very beginning of the story, I try to stress that Nepalis used tourists and tourism as a resource for their own projects, for their own agendas in ways that were often in contrast to the very things that the tourists themselves had come to find or escape. But so that's one of my agendas is to put agency back into the hands of Nepalis for this phenomenon that happened in their country. I also want to suggest that when we think about youth movements, that again, one of the things I try to stress is that there, the very similar kinds of youth movements were alive and stirring within Nepal at the same moment that those movements abroad were bringing young people to Nepal. And so you find Nepali youth being in effect radicalized or disenchanted by certain promises of modernity. And they show up in Kathmandu at the same time that these foreigners are showing up in Kathmandu. And so I guess, again, in part, I'm trying to suggest that what's happening in Nepal is not just it's not just a foreign phenomenon that is implanted into this Nepali space, but rather that Nepal is itself an actor on the very same world stage as the people that show up uninvited on its doorstep. What's happening in Nepal isn't just a derivative experience, but really a simultaneous co-production of a shared modern experience.
Yeah, and I think that comes across really well in the book, that we're all, as Westerners, as Nepalese, we're all in the modern world together. And that might look a little bit different for us in our different contexts. But there's definitely a strong sense in the book that there's an active collaboration and co-creation of these intercultural experiences. So yeah, it was a great read. I hope all of our listeners get the chance to dive into the book. And Mark, as our last question, I wanted to ask, what are you working on now? You said this book was a long time in the making. So how does it feel to have it finished and what's on the plate now?
Well, I'm glad to have it done. And it was a lot of fun to do, but I think I've said my piece, and I'm hoping that others will join the conversation. For now, I'm doing something completely different, which may be of no interest to readers of this book. But I spent a couple of years looking into the emergence of hydropower generation in Nepal, and I'm working on a kind of social history of infrastructural development around hydropower and some of the cultural politics of development that have surrounded that scenario. I could go into a lot more detail of that, but I don't know if you want to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, since you're still in the middle of the book, maybe we'll let it rest for now, but you can come back on the podcast and tell us more about it when the next book comes out.
Look forward to it.
Yeah. We'll look forward to that. Thank you so much, Mark.
Well, thank you, Dana. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, it's been a pleasure. Bye. That was my conversation with Mark Liechty about his excellent book, Far Out, Countercultural Seekers and the Tourist Encounter in Nepal. I hope you'll join us again next time for more fascinating conversations with authors here on the New Books Network. Thanks.